knew where the preacher could be found, it would be those fishermen and their wives. They had taken the carpenter's coming for granted. Surely they must know where he spent the rest of his day. There was no bustle at this hour. The Jews jested that no one worked in the heat of the day but dogs and soldiers. The heavy barges bumped each other lazily, waiting for the next day's cargo. But farther along the shore, he saw a few slow-moving figures, men lazily preparing their fishing boats for the night's work. Daniel approached a fisherman who was folding in a long net. "I am looking for a preacher," he said. "I heard him talking here one morning."
"You mean the carpenter?" The man nodded. "He's back in town again. He'll be here tomorrow without a doubt."
"Do you know where I could find him now?"
"That would be hard to do. Sometimes he goes about preaching. Sometimes he takes a wood-turning job. But at night, you could find him at the house of Simon Bar Jonas in Bethsaida. He sleeps there."
Bethsaida was scarcely 2 miles the other side of the city, and there were many hours to spare before nightfall. Daniel had the excuse he wanted. He climbed the hill to the house of Hezron. He located the hinged door, and it swung open at his touch. He picked up a sharp pebble and scratched the shape of a bow on the mud wall, and looking carefully up and down the street, crawled through the door and along the passage. He waited for a long time. Twice he cautiously pushed open the door and peered out, knowing by the shadows on the street that he must soon be on his way. When he had almost given up hope, Yoel came crawling along the passage.
"I've checked every day," he greeted Daniel. "I didn't think you'd come so soon."
"It was just luck," Daniel explained about the dagger.
"Are you all right, Daniel?"
"Thashia said your wound was not healed enough. You should have stayed here." With his usual thoughtfulness, Yoel had brought a small loaf of bread, which Daniel munched gratefully.
"I must find Simone," Daniel said. "It's time I started for Bethsaida."
He hesitated.
"Could you go with me? This Jesus, I'd like to know what you make of him."
Yoel considered. "There's talk about him everywhere," he said.
"Do you think he's a zealot?
Father says he is dangerous. I'd like to see him myself."
"Yes, I think I'll risk it."
At dusk, the two boys emerged from their hiding place, and Yoel led the way through unfrequented streets till they came out on the path above the lake. Below them, 4 men were sliding their boat into the water. As they watched, 3 of the men climbed aboard. One took the heavy oars in hand, the last man gave a shove, and the boat drifted slowly out from the shore, its image wavering on the glassy surface. The oarsman began to sing, and the others took up the melody. For a long time, as the boys walked on, the song floated back over the water with a strange sadness. The village of Bethsaida was a tumbled mass of fishing shacks in the gathering darkness. Smoky light glimmered from the open doors of the huts. They followed the one narrow street till presently they overtook a man and woman who walked slowly to keep pace with a small boy who stumbled between them. Before Daniel could speak, the man looked back and questioned them instead.
"Do you know which would be the house of Simon the fisherman?"
"We're looking for it ourselves,"
the man nodded. "With so many looking, it shouldn't be hard to find. But the boy is getting tired. We've walked all the way from Cana today. They told us in town that the preacher would be at the home of Simone tonight." Daniel glanced at the child, noting the way he hugged one arm close to his body, wrapping it in his mantle.
"It's his hand,"
the woman explained. They reached out and pulled the mantle aside. Both boys started at the glimpse of red, swollen flesh. The child flashed them a look of fury, jerked the mantle back into place, and trudged on, his eyes on the road.
"Bit by a camel," the man said. 2 months ago and it won't heal. I'm a weaver, and so the boy must be after me, and a weaver needs 2 good hands.
We only heard about the preacher yesterday, said the woman. We have not wasted any time.
Daniel was puzzled. This preacher, is he a doctor as well? He asked.
Where do you come from that you haven't heard about the preacher?
The man demanded.
Our neighbor who came back from Capernaum said that they talk of nothing else.
My neighbor saw him heal a man who had been lame for 20 years.
The man ran, he told me, ran like a young boy. If this preacher can do that, he can heal my son.
Daniel glanced at Yoel uneasily. Have you heard of this? He asked under his breath. Yoel hesitated.
There is talk. Father says...
He checked himself, and the two walked on silently, keeping their doubts to themselves. It seemed a shame to have made a child walk all the way from Cana. Presently, the murmur of many voices came to them. The sound drew them away from the street into an alley, at the end of which they made out the outline of a house. The square of light that was the doorway was choked by dark figures. People crowded the room inside and overflowed into the courtyard, blocking the path to the door. Some sat cross-legged on the ground or leaned against the gate. They seemed to be waiting. Daniel saw that many of them were ill. Some had been carried here and lay on the ground on crude litters. All about him, he saw canes and crutches and the glimmer of bandages. From one corner of the yard, smoke rolled from a clay oven, carrying a pungent odor of frying fish. The two boys stepped around the litters, and Daniel plucked the coat sleeve of a man who leaned on the doorpost. Peace, he said.
Peace, responded the man. There's no room inside. The master will be out when he has finished eating.
I'm looking for a friend of his, Daniel said. Simone the blacksmith. From Kitsa. Do you know of him?
The zealot? He's inside.
The man leaned into the door and called out.
Simone! There's one here asking for you.
The figures in the doorway shifted. Framed against the square of light, Simone peered out into the dim yard.
Here's Simone. It's Daniel from Kitsa.
Daniel!
There was genuine pleasure in the man's voice. I'm glad you found the place. Come inside. Have you eaten? They pushed their way into a small room, smoky, airless, overfull of dark bearded men. The smell of fresh bread, of fish, and burning oil made Daniel's head swim. He introduced his two friends to each other.
By the look of you, you've walked all the way from the mountain, said Simone. But first, you must meet the master.
One hand on each boy's elbow, he steered them across the room. Daniel stood face to face with the carpenter. The man's eyes, looking straight into his, blocked out every other thought. Filled with light and warmth, those eyes, welcoming him with friendship, yet searching too, disturbing, demanding. I am glad you have come, Jesus said. Daniel could say nothing at all. For a moment, he was afraid. Only when the man turned away and his eyes no longer held his own could he breathe freely again. Simone found a place for the boys between two burly fellows who reeked of fish and garlic. Someone had led Jesus to the seat of honor at the head of the table. Several women were moving now among the men, carrying wooden platters of bread and lettuce and small fish fried in oil. They placed the dishes on the mat before Jesus, and he looked up with a warm smile. You must have worked long, my daughters, he said, to provide a feast for so many. The women glanced sideways at each other, smiling, their brown faces flushed. Jesus reached out and took a wafer of bread from the plate. A voice spoke from the end of the table.
Teacher, a man said. No one has provided for us to wash our hands. In this house, do you not observe the law?
The woman of the house gasped, hand against her mouth in dismay. All her pride and pleasure was wiped out in an instant.
Was it needful?
her eyes pleaded with the carpenter. I did not think. So many.
Do not be distressed. Jesus answered her gently. It was not needful. He looked down the long mat toward the man who had spoken. In this house, the food has been given us with love, he said slowly. Let us make sure that our hearts, rather than our hands, are worthy to receive this gift.
He stood up, his long white robe holding the light, and spoke a blessing over the bread. Then he passed the platter to the one beside him. Daniel glanced at Yoel. With a pucker of confusion between his brows, Yoel had taken a small morsel of the bread and was putting it to his lips. Perhaps this was the first time in his life, Daniel realized, that Yoel had deliberately broken the law. He too must have felt the carpenter's words as a reproach. When the short meal was done, Jesus rose from the table, gave thanks again to God and to the woman of the house, then moved slowly through the crowded room to the door. Instantly, a clamor rose from the courtyard, a frenzy of wailing, shouting, pleading voices.
Let me touch you, Rabbi! Let me only touch the edge of your cloak! My son, Rabbi! He has had the fever for 7 days!
Over here, Master! Look this way! I cannot move for the crowd!
Jesus stood on the threshold for a moment, looking out over the wailing people. Daniel, who had pushed close behind him, almost reached out to hold him back. Those people out there, so frantic, they could tear a man to pieces. But Jesus stretched out his hand and spoke, and the clamor died away. A few voices kept on pleading. The moaning could not all be stilled. But once again, the crowd waited. Then Jesus stepped down into the courtyard and moved, with serenity, among them. Feeble hands reached out to him, stretched and grasped at his clothing. Some of the sick dragged forward, and when they could not reach him, kissed the ground behind him. Before one after another, Jesus stopped. Sometimes he spoke quietly. Sometimes he touched a man briefly, or a child. What he said, no one could hear. Suddenly, a scream rang out.
I am well!
A woman cried.
He has cured me! I am well!
The clamor rose again, drowning her out. The women who had served Jesus moved now among the crowd with the platters of food, and the bearded fishermen helped them. Hands snatched the food as it passed, cramming it into mouths, spilling it in frantic greed. Daniel understood now why those in the house had eaten so sparingly. There would never be enough to satisfy the starving horde. He shuddered, looking at them. Where had they come from, these wretched creatures who had dragged themselves to this place in the hope of a morsel of bread? Then Daniel saw the man and woman he had met on the road, standing almost within the reach of Jesus' hand. As Jesus turned, they pushed the child in front of them. The woman went down on her knees and hid her face. The man stood, his eyes fixed on Jesus. Then 4 men carrying a litter blocked them from Daniel's view. And when he saw them again, the 3 were going rapidly through the gate in the hedge. He sprang after them.
Did you see him? He demanded, catching up with them. Did he speak to you?
Tears were streaming down the woman's face. Her eyes were dazed, and she could not speak. The man had the same dazed look.
The boy is healed, he said. How do you know?
Daniel demanded. Have you looked at it?
No, I have not.
Show him your arm, the man ordered his son. The boy shook off the mantle and held out his hand.
It doesn't hurt anymore, he said, puzzled.
Daniel felt a sudden chill. He leaned closer.
It is still swollen,
he accused the man. The man did not look.
The pain is gone, he said. The swelling will go too.
What did he do? Did he touch it?
No, the man said. I don't think he touched it. I started to tell him what was wrong,
and I couldn't get the words out. I could only look at him, and then I knew that the boy was all right. Suddenly, Daniel was furious. "You are lying to me," he cried. "There is some trick." "Why should I lie to you?" The man looked back steadily. "I tell you, the boy's hand is healed, and now he will make a weaver." Back in the yard, Simone stood with Yoel. Daniel clutched at the older man. "That boy," he stammered. "Simone, he said his arm was healed." Simone did not ask what boy or seem surprised.
"Yes," he said quietly.
"But I saw it. We both saw it. Not an hour ago. The boy says it doesn't hurt."
"Several people were healed tonight," said Simone.
"It's impossible. Is it some trick?"
"You say you saw the arm yourself. What do you think?"
"I don't understand."
"Nor do I," Simone answered. "But I must believe my own eyes. I have seen it happen over and over."
Yoel spoke thoughtfully. "Is he a magician?"
"No magician could do the things he does. He claims that his power comes from God."
"But these other people, all these..."
"I don't know why they are not all healed. It seems to require something from the person himself, a sort of giving up. The child you saw, or his parents, must have had that sort of faith."
"Perhaps the arm would have healed anyway."
"Perhaps," said Simone.
He put a silencing hand on Daniel's arm.
"Wait now. He is going to speak."
For the third time, something in Daniel leaped to answer that voice. It was not a joyous voice tonight, or a commanding one, as it had been on the sunlit shore. This time, its gentleness rested on the suffering people like a comforting touch. But strength still poured through its calm tones and utter sureness. "Do not be afraid," Jesus said to them, "for you are the children of God. And does not a father understand the sorrow of his children and know their need? For I tell you, not even a sparrow falls to the ground without our Father seeing. And you are of more value than many sparrows. Try to bear your suffering with patience, because you know that God has made a place for you in his kingdom." The kingdom! Daniel looked about him. What good would it do to speak of a kingdom to these miserable wretches? What could it mean to them, when not one of them could lift a hand to fight for it? But he saw their faces, white, formless blots in the darkness, all lifted toward this man. He heard their harsh breathing all around him, stifled in their straining not to miss a word. They listened as though his words were food, and they could never get enough. "But you must be kind to each other and love each other," the voice was saying, "for each of you is precious in his sight." The figure in the white robe swayed slightly. In the dim light from the doorway, the man looked very weary. Instantly, one of the fishermen was at his side. Another came from the house with a lighted lamp. Together, shielding him from the people, they persuaded their master across the garden. The crowd watched them, quieted, almost stupefied, by the spell of that gentle voice. The three climbed the outside staircase of the house and entered the shelter on the roof. Daniel straightened his shoulders, trying to shake off the spell that seemed to bind him close to the silent crowd. At the same time, he remembered the errand that had brought him to this place. Simone listened, showing little interest in Roche's demands. Daniel was sure that Simone was going to refuse his request, but instead, the man looked at him keenly. "This Roche," he said thoughtfully, "you have a lot of faith in him, haven't you?" "Of course I have."
"All right. I don't have these things to spare in my own shop. But there is a shop here in the city, on the street of the ironworkers. You will know it by the bronze horseshoe over the doorway. I work for the owner sometimes.
Samuel is his name, and he owes me wages. Tell him to give you what you need.
But your wages?
I have a little need for money just now. Take what you need. Daniel could not leave his friend without some answer.
Are you staying with Jesus, Simone?
If he will have me.
Is he one of us?
Simone smiled. A zealot, you mean?
Isn't that why you came? Have you asked him to join us?
I had some such idea when I came, Simone admitted. But it has not worked out just as I expected. No, I have not asked Jesus to join us. All I hope and long for now is that he will ask me to join him.
Daniel saw that he would get no more certain answer from Simone tonight.
The two boys went back along the road in silence. Presently, Yoel spoke, his young voice troubled.
How can he call those people children of God?
He questioned.
They have never heard of the law. They are unclean from the moment they are born.
Daniel could not attach too much importance to this. He was too far outside the law himself.
Perhaps it does no harm for them to hope, he suggested.
But they have no right to hope.
Yoel was silent again, struggling, in some way Daniel could not share, to reconcile what he had heard with his lifelong training.
I think Father is right, he said at last, unwillingly.
This man is not a true rabbi. He practically said it was all right to eat without washing our hands.
Perhaps it's dangerous even to listen to him.
And yet, some unfinished question, only half formed, filled the darkness around them as they made their way back to the city.
9. The Bronze Bow. 5 mornings later, Daniel sat at the foot of the mountain trail waiting. Though the sun weighed down on his head like a vast hammer, the palms of his hands were cold and damp. Any moment now, the man he waited for would come into view. This was the first job he had ever had to do alone. He must not bungle it. Of course, there was little likelihood he could fail, or Roche would not have sent him. He understood that, in a way, this was a peace offering on Roche's part, to repay him for mending the dagger. It was also, he knew, a test, the easy sort of test that Roche often devised to try out a man's usefulness.
He'll be alone, Roche told him. Always travels alone. The old skinflint by the back roads. Pretends to be a beggar, whining at everyone he meets for a mite of bread for his next meal.
He could buy the Tetrarch's palace if he wanted to.
He lives like a pauper, and every month he carries a bag of gold across the mountains to the coast and smuggles it to a friend who's buying property for him in Antioch. One day he'll disappear and spend the rest of his life living like a king. But he reckons with me first. This bagful comes to me.
This was Roche's idea of justice, and the kind of sport that most delighted him. He made it sound like a privilege that Daniel should have the chance. Daniel agreed with him on principle. Why should one greedy old miser live like a king in Antioch while his fellow Jews toiled and starved? Moreover, the thing would be done quickly. A lonely stretch of road, a moment's bluffing, and the man would go on his way unharmed, but not until he had made a contribution to his country's freedom.
Fair enough, Daniel reasoned.
Still, his stomach was uneasy. After nearly an hour's wait, he spotted the man on a bend of the road just below. He slid behind a rock and waited. The man climbed slowly, with a wheezing sigh at each step. He would have fooled anyone with his rags and his tottering gait. The deceit of the man made the job he had to do seem easier. When the miser was fairly opposite the rock, Daniel pounced. The man did not resist him. He cringed and sank to his knees. A poor man, he moaned, with not a thing that anyone could want. Daniel jerked him back to his feet and reached for the girdle. Then, like a snake, the man struck.
Daniel caught the gleam of the knife barely in time to grip the man's wrist. He saw the cold glitter of the man's eyes. For a moment, they struggled in deadly silence. Who could have guessed that that bony frame would have so much strength? Then Daniel saw the second dagger, this time in the man's left hand. With one mighty, unthinking thrust, his own fist came up, and the man crumpled back across the path. Daniel stood breathing hard. Then he stooped and felt for the man's girdle. The money bag was there all right, a fat one. He stuffed it into his own girdle and turned away. The thing was done. At the turn of the road, he looked back. The man lay sprawled on the road, and suddenly a long-forgotten memory hit Daniel's stomach with the thud of a blow. For a moment he stood, feeling wretchedly sick, and then he remembered. How many times in his childhood had he waked in the early morning and seen his grandfather lying just like that on the mat beside him, cap slipped sideways off the pinkish scalp, scrawny neck muscles stretched like a half-grown chicken's. Curse Roche! Daniel knew what the orders were. He should get away from this place as fast as possible. He looked behind him up the pathway at the rocky hillside. If anyone were watching, he would be laughed out of camp. But he could not leave an old man who looked like his grandfather lying helpless on the road. He went back and knelt down, his throat suddenly like ice, and fumbled in the rags over the man's chest. With relief, he recognized an uncertain beat of life under the bony ribs. He picked the man up, carried him to the side of the road, and laid him down in the shadow of a rock. Then he sat down and waited. It was some time before the man regained consciousness. Finally, he blinked and turned his head, and Daniel was suddenly angered by the terror that leaped into the old eyes. "Lie still," he said roughly. "I'm not going to touch you. Wait till you're able to walk." But the old man would not wait. He jerked to his feet and backed away. "Wait," said Daniel. "Take this. You may need it." He held out one of the daggers that less than an hour ago had threatened his own life. Then he stood watching till the man, in a tottering course, dragged around the turn of the road by which he had come. Back in camp, he flung the money bag at Roche's feet. Roche snatched it up, weighed it rapidly from one horny palm to the other, jerked open the strings, and poured out a glittering heap of coins onto the stone. He slapped them down as they bounced and rolled.
"Yay!" he gloated. "A good morning's pay. He's got something to whine about now, the old camel."
Daniel said nothing, waiting.
"Did you get his dagger too?"
Daniel threw the dagger down. He knew now what was coming. Someone had already brought back a report.
"The other one?"
"I gave it back to him," said Daniel. "He wasn't fit to travel without it." Roche shot a derisive glance from under the black brows.
"So he took you in with his whining. I gave you credit for more sense."
Daniel held his tongue. Roche rubbed a coin between dirty thumb and finger.
"You think he'll thank you for your pains? You'll find out if he ever sets eye on you in the city. You should have finished him off."
"You didn't order me to kill him," Daniel said sullenly.
"I expected you to use your head. What ails you? Afraid of a drop of blood?"
"It is Roman blood I want," Daniel burst out. "Do we fight against Jews?"
Roche tossed the coins back into the bag, pulled the string tight, and got to his feet. His eyes looked dangerous, but his voice was level.
"You fool! You'll have your fill of Roman blood. Have you wasted your time with me? Are you still a stupid villager who wants to rush at the Romans with your bare hands? It will take men and arms and food, and they have to be paid for with money. And get this through your head once and for all. We take the money where we find it."
Daniel's lips were tight, his eyes on the hard-packed earth.
"Would the old miser have given his money to free Israel?
Roche went on. He'd have parted with his life first. A decent death for his country was better than he deserved. And what loss would it have been? One old man more or less? Suddenly, with one of his lightning reverses of temper, Roche stepped forward and laid a hand on the boy's shoulder. I know what's in your mind, he said gruffly. It's better to do without killing when we can. But there's a flaw in you, boy. A soft streak. I've seen it over and over these years. Like a bad streak in a piece of metal. Either you hammer it out the way you'd hammer out a bubble, or you'll be no good to us. When the day comes, there'll be no place for weakness.
Daniel's head went back.
Wait a minute! Roche warned, bearing his hand down as if to hold down the boy's leaping anger. I didn't say cowardice. You think I don't know you inside out? But softness can be just as dangerous. And by all the prophets, I'm going to hammer it out of you if it's the last thing I do. Someday, you'll thank me for it. Roche took his hand from the boy's shoulder and held it out, waiting.
Daniel stared at the bearded, weather-pitted face, the fierce black eyes of the man who had been his hero for 5 years, and his defenses gave way. Was it Roche's logic, or the rough friendship in the man's hand and voice that had won him back? In relief, he reached out, and he could sense the man's pleasure when his own hand, trained to the anvil, returned without flinching his leader's iron clasp. Roche was right, he thought later, taking up his work. More right than Roche himself suspected. Would the man be so patient if he could read Daniel's mind? Roche knew about his passion for the day to come. Roche did not know about the other things that bound him like cobwebs when he woke in the night. Leia, his grandmother, Thashia. A flush came over his face. There was no room for such weakness. He raised the anvil and struck the softened metal, blow after powerful blow, beating out his weakness. He put the metal back into the fire and watched it heat to a glowing red, drew it out with tongs, and hammered on it again till his arms ached. He would get rid of this flaw in himself. Yet, like a treacherous bubble that fled under the hammer and formed again, a doubt returned. Was there a flaw, too, in Roche's argument? He could not put a finger on it, but he felt it just the same. He wished he could talk to Yoel about it. Could Yoel find the answer in those scriptures of his? Somewhere, Daniel had been taught in his childhood. There would be an answer in the scriptures, for Moses had handed down in the law an answer for every situation a man could encounter in his life. Thou shalt not kill? But that did not apply to war. And what difference would it make if he had an answer, chapter, and verse on his tongue? Roche was his own law. Suddenly, words were echoing in his mind. For each one of you is precious in his sight. Not scripture, but the words of the carpenter. That was what had confused him. Roche looked at a man and saw a thing to be used, like a tool or a weapon. Jesus looked and saw a child of God. Even the old miser with his money bag? He hammered more violently, till the sparks flew wild and the iron squashed down on the stone like clay, and he had to heat it again and begin all over. Samson, kneading the bellows, watched him broodingly. 10. The Bronze Bow. Avol, the sentry, brought the message to Daniel one sultry August morning, a single sentence scratched on a fragment of broken pottery. Your grandmother is dying. And signed, Simone. The message had been in Avol's pocket for 3 days. No knowing how many times it had changed hands before reaching him. Better if it had never reached him at all, Daniel thought fiercely, thrusting it deep into his girdle pocket. For half the day, he carried it about with him, saying nothing, the bit of clay weighing heavier and heavier till it dragged at him like a stone. Finally, he showed the message to Roche and set off down the mountain to the village. The door of his grandmother's house was bolted, and only silence answered his knock. As he stood uncertain in the road before the house, two women and then a feeble old man came hurrying from the nearest house.
"About time you came," one of the women scolded. "They've been locked in there for 10 days. We don't know whether the old woman is alive or dead."
"Why didn't you break in?" Daniel asked.
"The girl is possessed of devils," the old man answered. "She will let nobody come near her."
"We tossed bread through the window," a woman added. "But I'll have no more to do with it. Suppose the devils were let loose."
"My sister is harmless," Daniel told them impatiently. "She could hurt no one." But probably none of them had even glimpsed his sister in all these years. He could see that he could expect no help from them. He looked up at the small, high window. Then he wrenched a portion of the ladder from the wall, braced it, and tried to peer into the house. He could see nothing but a patch of floor. There was no sound, but just as he turned away, he thought he caught the flicker of a shadow.
"Leia,"
he called, softly at first, then insistently. "It's Daniel, your brother. Let me in." The shadow did not move again. Panic crept over him. What horror did that room contain? With all his heart, he longed to run from this silent house. Yet the fearful, demanding eyes of the three neighbors goaded him on. He had no choice. He would have to break down the door and go in. At the second thrust of his powerful shoulders, the hinges burst from the rotting frame, and he fell forward into foul-smelling darkness. Sunlight poured in behind him, lighting up a crouching figure with a mass of tangled yellow hair. For an instant, Leia's eyes stared wildly from an ashen face. Then she darted away and coiled into a tight ball of fear against the wall. Where the girl had crouched, on a pallet of straw, lay a shrunken gray shape. Dread froze Daniel on the threshold. Then, to his shattering relief, his grandmother slowly turned her head.
"Daniel, you've come," she whispered.
They were the last words he was ever to hear from her. Daniel drove away the two curious women and sent the old man for a doctor. He kicked the door all the way open and let fresh air into the damp, fetid room. He threw out the rat-gnawed loaves of bread that littered the floor. The doctor bent over the old woman and shook his head.
"Only her will has kept the life in her," he said. "She has waited till you came.
Let her go now, poor soul. Look to your sister instead, and see that she eats." Daniel had no knowledge of nursing. Clumsily, he spread a fresh bread of rushes and shifted the weightless old body. He walked to the well and filled the jar with water and bathed the hands, thin and dry as shriveled leaves. One of the neighbors called from the roadway and handed him a bowl full of broth and a clay dish of hot coals to light a fire. He piled straw into the hollow in the floor and built a fire against the damp. He tried to coax the old woman to take a sip of the broth. In all this time, Leia had not moved from the wall. Once or twice, from the corner of his eyes, he noticed that she had very slightly turned her head, and he suspected that she watched him from behind the tangled hair. He tried not to look at her, to crowd back the fear that rose in him at the sight of her disheveled figure. She had been shut in here in the dimness for 10 days. Had the devils taken possession of her altogether? Daniel went out into the garden and milked the little goat, awkwardly, the feel of it gradually coming back into his hands. He carried the jar of milk into the house and set it on a shelf. The goat followed him through the broken door, sniffing timidly at the unfamiliar smell of him. Daniel was reminded that the door must be mended before it was too dark to see. The goat circled the room and found Leia, and he saw her hand go out and her fingers grip the black fur. Night was coming on. He mended the door after a fashion and propped it against the frame. Then he discovered that there was no oil in the lamp, How many nights had they gone without a light? He had not thought to ask Roche for money, and though it was too dark now to search the room, he doubted there would be a single coin hidden there. Just as darkness fell, there was a timid knock on the door. The second neighbor, the one who had most feared the devils, held out to him a small saucer of oil with a flaming wick. He accepted the lamp with shame. Through all these years, when he had thought of the village, he had remembered the poverty, the dinginess, the quarreling, and meanness and despair. He had forgotten there was kindness, too. He put the lamp on the floor and sat down near his grandmother's mat. He was all at once very tired, more tired than after a day at the forge or a long hunt over the mountain. Dread began to creep along his nerves again. He knew he was terribly afraid to spend the night in this place. Roche was right. There was a weakness in him. That devil of fear that held his sister helpless, was it cunning enough to find out his weakness? If he could run, out into the street, back to the mountain, it could never overtake him. But he could not run. He could only sit, while the fear reached closer and closer, hemming in the small circle of light that held it at bay. Sometimes his grandmother stirred, the thin wrinkled eyelids opened, and the faded eyes groped toward him. If he spoke to her, she closed her eyes again, satisfied. How had she been so sure that he would come? What had he ever done for her that she would dare to believe he would come back? He wished now he could tell her why he had run away. He wished that he could explain about Roche, could let her know that it was for her too that he worked on the mountain. But it was too late for that. The only thing he could do was sit here beside her, to let her be sure that he was there. Perhaps if she could hear him, she would not have to make such an effort to see. He began to talk, as he had talked that night to Samson while he filed off the chains, not knowing whether anyone heard or understood, but out of some need in himself. "You thought I had forgotten," he said. "But I remember how it used to be when Leia and I first came to live with you. Your hair was still so black, Grandmother. You worked in the Ketza field that summer, but at night, you used to tell us stories." There was no sound, not from the still figure or from the corner. But was it his imagination that a faint softening, almost like a smile, relaxed the thin, tight lips? He went on talking. "You were the one who told me the story of Daniel, the prophet I was named for. How when Daniel refused to stop praying to his God, Darius cast him into a den of lions, and how God sent an angel and shut the lions' mouths, and Daniel was not hurt. And about the three men who walked in the fiery furnace, and not a hair of their heads was singed. I can remember their names still. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. I used to like the sound of them. You made me feel proud of being named Daniel." There was a faint stir in the corner. Daniel did not turn his head. He went on talking. "At night, before we went to sleep, you made us repeat a psalm after you. I have forgotten them now, but there's one I think I could remember, the one you liked best." He fumbled for the words, and they came, slowly, from the depths of his memory. "The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. He maketh me to lie down in green pastures. He leadeth me beside the still waters. He restoreth my soul. He leadeth me in the paths of righteousness for his name's sake." There was a hesitant footstep beside him. Not knowing what to do, not daring to look up, with the cold prickle of fear along his skin, Daniel held out his hand. He felt Leia's fingers touch his own. He forced himself to go on. "Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil, for thou art with me. Thy rod and thy staff, they comfort me. Thou preparest a table before me in the presence of mine enemies. Thou anointest my head with oil. My cup runneth over. Surely goodness and mercy shall follow me all the days of my life, and I will dwell in the house of the Lord forever." Leia sank down beside him. Side by side,
Without speaking, the brother and sister sat and listened to the breathing of the old woman. Leia's hand in his own was like the hand of a small child reaching out to him in trust and helplessness. It was a sign that even now the devils did not have complete dominion. Fear retreated into the shadowy corners. There were only the small sounds, the hiss of the wick in the saucer of oil, the wheezing and sighing of the sleeping goat, the ceaseless rustling in the thatch overhead, where countless small creatures nested in the molding straw. Once, the thin thread of a snake swung down, twisted back on itself, and disappeared. A rat came out of the shadows, sat on its haunches, and glared at them. Leia looked at them both without surprise or alarm. Sometime in the night, he was aware that one sound in the room had ceased. His grandmother was no longer breathing. 11. The Bronze Bow. Next morning, a meager funeral procession straggled through the village toward the burial ground outside the gates. There were no flutes, no hired mourners, only a scattering of neighbor women wailing half-heartedly, and the trundling cart that carried the body of the old woman. Leading the procession was the lone mourner, a broad-shouldered young man with a fierce, forbidding scowl. After the burial was over, Daniel, turning homeward, saw a hurrying figure coming from the village, and presently, with a burst of gratitude, he recognized his friend, the blacksmith. "I am sorry, my friend," Simone said, wringing his hand. "I tried to get here in time for the burial. I'll go back to your house with you, if you don't mind." Simone was the only guest at the funeral feast, which the neighbors spread outside the house. They ate in silence, and when the woman had cleared away the dishes and left them alone, Simone turned to Daniel. "What now?" he asked. "Is there more to be done?" Daniel asked wearily. "I meant tomorrow. What are you going to do?" Daniel looked away. Since he had received Simone's message, he had not managed to ask himself that question. "I had another reason for coming today," Simone went on. "I told you in Capernaum that I intended to follow Jesus, but it weighs on my conscience that the smithy is closed. The money does not matter. I've learned to do without that. But it worries me that the tools lie idle while the men have no one to mend their plows. It has been on my mind for some time that you might help me. If you could take over the shop while I'm gone, keep the place from going to seed, I'll be very grateful to you." It was like Simone to make it sound like a favor. Daniel stared down at the road and kicked up a spurt of dust with his bare foot. He was almost at the point of tears. Yet in the same instant, such a fierce resentment sprang up in him that he dared not look his friend in the face. They had it all worked out for him. Everyone, the doctor, Leia, the neighbors, and now Simone, took it for granted that he had come home to stay. Did he have nothing to say about it? What about his life on the mountain? What about Roche and Samson and the work that must be done in the cave? Wasn't that more important than a few farmers who wanted their wheels mended? Everything he loved, the wind on the mountaintop, the irresponsible life, the excitement of the raids, rose up and fought off the shackles that Simone held out to him in kindness. The battle did not last long. He was trapped. Simone knew he was trapped. Though he longed to defy them all and fight for his freedom like a mountain wolf, the weakest one of them had defeated him. He could not leave Leia to sit alone in a house with the door barred. Simone, who had waited without speaking a word, was carefully looking off down the narrow street when Daniel finally raised his eyebrows. "Will they bring their business to me?" the boy asked miserably. "That will depend on you," Simone smiled. "If I can find someone to care for Leia while I work." "I had thought of that too," Simone said. "My house is connected with the shop. No use having it empty." "Why don't you both move in there and use my things? Better to have her where you could keep an eye on her yourself." not a word about the crumbling mud or the sagging roof or the gaping door which Simone could see plainly from where he stood. Daniel's throat suddenly ached.
Thank you, he managed. It is good. It's just good business, Simone said crisply. I'm sure of your work. I know my reputation is in good hands.
He went on, in a practical tone, explaining some of the problems of the trade, the work that this or that man was likely to demand. One more thing, he added. From time to time, not often, one of the legionaries comes into the shop for something, a broken harness or clasp. They have their own forge at the garrison, of course, but sometimes a man needs a repair done quickly.
Daniel bristled. I will never serve a pig of a Roman.
Yes, said Simone levelly. You will serve him, and civilly, too. There is something you will have to learn, my friend. An outlaw may think he is accountable to no one. But in a village, every man holds his neighbor's safety in his hands. If a legionary is in a mood for trouble, any excuse will do. A single insult could cost half the lives in the town in the end. This is one thing I must ask of you.
To Daniel, it seemed the final blow that struck his shackles into place. Simone laughed.
It's not so bad as all that. After all, a horse deserves a comfortable bridle whether he belongs to a Roman or no. Besides, a good zealot does not bring down suspicion on his roof.
Daniel looked at his friend sharply.
Did Simone mean?
Did you think you had to give up serving your country? All the patriots don't live in the mountain. There are zealots in blacksmith shops, too. Do what you will. The place is yours now, so long as no harm comes to my neighbors. Can I count on you for that?
You can count on that, the boy said, feeling a measure of hope and a great gratitude toward his friend.
I'm going back to Capernaum tonight, Simone said. Perhaps you can find a neighbor to help you move your things.
Before dark, Daniel climbed the mountain and explained to Roche that he must stay in the village. Roche heard him out in silence. Then he spoke.
This witless sister is more important than your country's freedom?
Daniel flushed. No, but I cannot leave her alone.
They boast of charity in the synagogue, don't they? Let them care for her.
Daniel remembered the untouched loaves of bread tossed through the window.
She would starve, he said. I have said it before, Roche said with scorn. You're soft.
This time, Daniel did not look away. He faced his chief levelly.
I will prove you are wrong, he said quietly. I will work for the cause in the village. You will see that. I belong here on the mountain. I'll never forget that. But now I am going back, and tomorrow I will move into the house of Simone the Zealot.
Next morning, he cleared out the little house. There was practically nothing worth taking. Surely there had been more than this in the days when he had lived with his grandmother. He remembered very clearly a blue glazed dish she had cherished and a red woolen rug that had hung against the wall. Probably she had sold them for food. The decent and usable things he could salvage from the whole house went into a very small pack. Since his grandmother had died, Leia had sat quietly, waiting, her hands folded. Like a small child, she did as she was told, ate what he brought to her.
Will grandmother be hungry?
She asked once. No, Daniel answered.
Is it cold where she is?
She will never be hungry or cold again, he promised her. Now he explained to her as gently as he could that they must move. Simone's house is much nicer than this. It will keep out the rats and the rain and the cold in winter. You will have a mattress to sleep on like a rich girl. She listened with wide, unfathomable blue eyes, and he thought she understood. But when the moment came to leave, he saw he was mistaken. As he opened the door, she shrank from the sunlight as though it were a sword. Outside in the roadway, a handful of neighbors had gathered to watch his departure.
One glimpse of them sent Leia cowering against the wall. Nothing Daniel could say persuaded her to move a step. Daniel's impatience mounted. He was tempted to pick her up and carry her without any nonsense. But some instinct told him that if he laid a finger on her by force, he might never win her back again. Finally, he went out to speak to the neighbors. "It is no good," he told them. "She can't abide being looked at. We could never get across the town. I will have to leave her here alone while I'm working."
"Better tie her up,"
one man advised, keeping the width of the road between him and the house.
"Kin of mine has a daughter is possessed. They've kept her on a chain all her life."
Daniel shook his head. He'd seen such people, poor, raving creatures tied to trees like dogs. Before he put a rope on Leia, he would stay in this house till it crumbled to pieces around them. He went back into the house and slammed the door behind him, sending a shower of dust and clay across the floor. In the afternoon, he answered a cautious knock. Just outside the door stood a vehicle so extraordinary that he stood peering out at it, not realizing what it could be. An aged carpenter who lived a short way down the road stood beside the thing, grinning.
"It's a litter," he explained, "like those fancy Roman ladies ride around in. Lift your sister in, and she'll be as snug as in her own bed. My wife sewed all our cloaks together to make the curtains. There's four men ready to carry it for you, but we'll stay out of sight till she's inside."
A lump rushed up against Daniel's throat. Once again, he felt shamed. Why should they show such kindness to a stranger and an outcast? When every neighbor had tactfully vanished from the street, Daniel unveiled Leia into taking one look through the door. "That's the way queens travel," he told her. "The way the Queen of Sheba came to visit King Solomon. You will sit inside it and we'll pull the curtains tight around you. In no time at all, we'll be at the new house." She shook her head. He did not hurry her. He could see that her curiosity was piqued. From time to time, the blue eye slanted toward the door.
"No one can see me in there?"
she asked finally. "Not so much as your little finger."
"Do I have to go away from here, Daniel?"
"I want you to be near me when I work. Wouldn't you like that, Leia?" After a long time, she seemed to give in. She moved toward the door and stood, still terrified. Then, before she could refuse again, Daniel picked her up. She hid her face against his shoulder, whimpering, but she did not scream. He lifted her gently into the